The following is a production of Pediascribe.com. Pediacast, a pediatric podcast for parents. Episode 8 for the week of September 11th, 2006.
Hello, mums, dads, grandmums, grandpas, aunts, uncles, and anyone else who looks after kids. Welcome to this week's episode of Pediacast, a pediatric podcast for parents. And now, direct from Birdhouse Studios, here's your host, Dr. Mike Patrick Jr.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of Pediacast, a pediatric podcast for parents. This is Dr. Mike Patrick Jr. coming to you from Birdhouse Studio, and as usual, we have a program packed with information for moms and dads. This week is episode 8, and our topics up for discussion this week include baby shoes, birth order, are firstborn smarter than subsequent children in the same family? There's some dinner table conversation for you. Growth charts for infants and toddlers, are changes coming? And we'll also discuss vision exams by eye doctors, who should get them and when? And then in our teenage segment, we'll spend some time looking at eating disorders such as anorexia nervosa and bulimia. All of this plus an interview with a 12-year-old homeschool student and pod-safe music to round things out. Our featured artist this week is Tim Jennings, so you'll want to keep your headphones plugged in because his music will be coming up a little bit later on in the program. Now, don't forget, here at Pediacast, we'd love to hear from you, so if you have a question or a topic you would like us to address on the program, you can reach us through the contact page on our website. Simply go to www.pediascribe.com/podcast and click on the contact link. You can also email us at podcast@pediascribe.com or use our voicemail system to leave comments and questions by calling 347-404-KIDS. That's 347-404-KIDS. Now, before we get started, I would like to take a quick time out to thank the folks over at Upon Further Review for featuring Pediacast on episode 13 of their program. That's great, guys. Do the Pediacast review on show 13. You know, don't you think podcasts should be like hotels? You know, just skip from show 12 to show 14 and not even mention the missing program? I'll have to think about that one as my own number 13 approaches. Anyway, thanks go out to Greg and Clea for providing their listeners with a fair evaluation of our program. They gave Pediacast an 8 out of 10 rating and provided both encouragement and constructive criticism to help us improve, which is always appreciated. If you haven't heard of their pod show, I suggest you check it out. They're kind of like the Consumer Reports of the podcasting world. You can find Upon Further Review in the iTunes Music Store and at their website, which is www.furtherreview.net. And they, by the way, they don't just review podcasts. They really review just about everything and anything you can think of. It's a great show, really. We'll put a link over to their site in the show notes. So again, Greg and Clea, thanks for checking us out. All right, I think we're ready to move into the first topic up for discussion on the program, which would be in the infant segment. And as we get that started, I just want to remind you that the information presented in Pediacast should not be taken as substitution for the advice of your child's doctor. No radio program or podcast can offer patient-specific information. Got to get my lips moving today. We don't try to do that, and you shouldn't ask us to. The final word on diagnosis and treatment must come from a doctor who can obtain a face-to-face interview and hands-on physical examination of your child. What we can and will do is discuss generic child health, parent, and family issues, which do not necessarily pertain to your child or family-specific situation. Okay, and now that we've made the lawyers happy, let's move along with the program. The first segment will be the infant segment, and the first topic up for discussion is baby shoes. Now, the purpose of infant shoes is simply to protect the feet. They do not help infants walk any sooner, and shoes may actually delay walking to some degree. Bare feet enable infants to use their toes for balance and gives them a better sense of foot placement during the learning to walk process. So if your infant's walking on a surface that may hurt or injure the feet, then shoes are required. You know, examples of that would be if they're walking on cold outside surfaces or hot pavement, gravel, you know, other kind of rough terrain like that. So let's say that they're going to walk on something that's kind of tough and you want to protect their feet. What do you use? Well, I think a good first shoe is going to be an infant moccasin. It's going to protect the bottom surface while still allowing a good degree of foot movement and flexibility. So that's where I would start, is with an infant moccasin, if you've probably seen those around. But then I would advance pretty quickly to an infant tennis shoe or a soft-sided low-cut boot. These are generally comfortable, and they're going to provide better traction than the smooth-soled moccasins. And traction may help infants with walking, but you have to keep in mind, for some other infants, it may actually hinder them, as the traction sort of catches, causing the child to stumble, especially in the early weeks of walking, or when you first switch over to a shoe that has traction on it. What I would definitely avoid are the classic infant shoes, you know, those hard-sided, high-cut boots that we usually imagine when we're talking about infant shoes. But, you know, they're uncomfortable, they have poor ventilation, and while their stiffness may seem like a good idea to provide support for early walkers, really their lack of flexibility hinders more than it helps. Now let's talk about size and fit of baby shoes. The key here is that infants have really wide feet, so you want to look for shoes made by a manufacturer who specializes in baby shoes. Even though these shoes will cost you more, they'll likely fit better because the manufacturer knows through experience that young walkers have wide feet. It's a case of really you get what you pay for. Bargain brands are often too narrow, which can result in pain, sores, and blisters. Now, when you read a lot of child and infant advice out there, you know, they'll tell you, oh, you don't have to get the expensive shoes, just stick with the cheap stuff. But I really find that the kids who I see with feet sores and rashes and things of that nature, they usually are in cheaper shoes. So again, you get what you pay for. The feet should fit snugly in the shoe, but not really be crammed inside. And then again, not so loose that the shoe slips around. Ideally, the big toe should be about a half an inch from the front tip of the shoe, and the heel should rest against the back of the shoe pretty nicely. Now, the width of the infant shoe should be slightly wider than your infant's foot. Now, keep in mind, early walkers grow quickly, so you'll want to recheck the fit often. Shoe size may need to change anywhere from 2 to 4 times during the first year of walking, really depending on how fast your child grows. If you do go with the more expensive but better-fitting brands, your child will probably outgrow the shoes before he wears them out. That's fine. Just save them for the next child, or you could donate them to a family in need. Now, in terms of recommendations, what brands do I suggest? There are a couple I want to tell you about, but before I do, I want to be clear that neither of these brands sponsor Pediacast. But if there are any representatives out there, call me. We'll see what we can do. StrideRite is the first one. Now, our family's had lots of personal experience with StrideRite shoes. We used them for both kids when they were early walkers, and we found them to be well-fitting. They were comfortable and durable. And really, StrideRite has a long experience in making infant and toddler shoes. Each style usually comes in a variety of widths, which make a good fit easier to obtain. And the salespeople are usually knowledgeable and proficient in taking accurate foot measurements. You come up with a dud salesman now and then, but most of the salespeople that we ran into were experienced and were of great help. Just a couple of them that weren't so good. But, you know, having two kids who went through all the infant and toddler years, that's saying something. They also, at StrideRite, have a pretty liberal return policy if there's any problems with the fit or with the craftsmanship. And you can find StrideRite at www.striderite.com. They spell it STRIDERITE. So www.striderite.com. And if you head over to the show notes after the program, we'll have a link up to their site. Now, the other brand I want to tell you about is called Preschoolians. Now, this is a brand that's currently available only online, and this makes it a bit harder to fit. But they do have explicit directions for measuring your child's feet, and they have a reasonable return policy if you get shoes that you're not happy with or the fit's not quite right. Now, the cool thing about the Preschoolians is that the clear rubber sole at the toe of the shoe. So the toe of the shoe has a clear rubber sole. So you can see exactly where your child's toes are located compared to the tip of the shoe. That's pretty cool. They also have the option of custom designing the shoe style and color scheme. It costs more to customize them, but it's an interesting option that I haven't seen out there before. Now, I have to say, I don't have any personal experience with Preschoolians, so I'm basing my analysis only on what I've seen on their website. If anyone out there has tried them, shoot me an email or voice message telling us what you think, and we'll share the information with our listeners. Now, the Preschoolians you can find at www.preschoolians.com. I'm going to spell that for you. It's Preschool, just like preschool, and then add I-A-N-S. So www.preschoolians, pediascribe.com. And as usual, we'll put a link over to their site in this week's show notes. Okay, moving on to our second infant topic. This one is birth order and intelligence. Now, there have been some studies in the past which found a possible link between birth order and intelligence. And these studies suggested that firstborn children did better on intelligence tests than subsequent children in the same family. So to see if these results were reproducible, researchers at The Ohio State University, my alma mater, embarked on a new study. Their investigation followed nearly 3,000 families over a 12-year period, and then they conducted intelligence tests between the ages of 7 and 8, and then again between the ages of 13 and 14, and then they compared that data to birth order to see if firstborn scored higher than subsequent kids in the same family. Now, they also compared families to one another to see if any environmental factors were associated with overall higher scores for the family as a whole. Okay, so what kind of results did they get? Well, subsequent born kids, you can all breathe a sigh of relief out there if you're a second, third, or fourth born child. No significant differences were found in this study at any age when comparing kids from the same family. However, significant differences were seen when comparing families with each other. Basically, they found that the older that the mother was when she had her firstborn resulted in overall higher scores for the family. Now, this doesn't mean that smart people have kids later, but it may be an indication. Actually, I think smart people probably have their kids earlier, so you have a little bit more time with them out of the house. You know what I'm saying? But anyway, what this may be is an indication that older parents spend more time stimulating their kids during key phases of development. Now, another variable was family size. Families with fewer children had higher intelligence test scores than larger families. And again, this may suggest that fewer numbers of children in the house result in parents spending more time with each child, which might make a big difference. Now, this study did not look into the reasons these relationships held. I'm only making a guess when I say the increased stimulation with the older the parent and the less kids in the house. But, you know, I think it would be interesting to know why older parents why older parents with fewer kids appeared to have the smartest children. And I bet the reason is increased time and stimulation put into each child. But I could be wrong. It'd make for an interesting expansion on the study, that's for sure. But, you know, we also have to keep this in mind. We are talking about kids taking intelligence tests. And these tests are not always a true indicator of a child's potential. Test-taking skills are influenced by things such as learning differences and attention problems, too. So there may be a socioeconomic, cultural, language barriers that affect intelligence testing and a dampen intelligence potential. So I think the bottom line, it's important to expose every child, whether first, second, or third born, really to as much stimulation as early as possible. And this includes reading and music and playtime and games. You really can't spoil your kids this way. So put down the newspaper, close your novel, turn off the TV, log off the internet, get down on the floor and play with your kids. Why? Because it's important. Okay, we're going to move on into the toddler section of the program, and we're going to start with growth charts. Are changes coming? Growth charts currently used in the doctor's office come from the CDC, which is the Center for Disease Control, and they're based on population data during the 1970s and the 1980s. What they basically did to come up with these growth charts is they recorded the birth weights and lengths of 82 million infants, and then they also recorded these measurements on 5,000 kids between 2 months and 24 months of age and 10,000 kids between 2 and 6 years of age. The only exclusions were very low birth weight premature infants, and there was a nice mix of breastfed versus formula-fed babies, and the sample really came from a cross-section of the U.S. population and included a broad collection of socioeconomic groups and racial backgrounds. So they took this big mix of kids, they did a bunch of fancy statistical analysis on their weights and heights, and they came up with the charts that we use to plot kids' growth. If you've taken an infant or a child to the doctor's office, you know what I'm talking about here. It's the chart where we say a kid is 25th percentile or 50th percentile or 75th percentile or greater than the 95th percentile, which we're seeing more and more of. So why do we need new curves? Well, the World Health Organization didn't like comparing the world's kids to American children from the 70s and 80s. Why, surprise, surprise. So they recently did their own statistical analysis with data from six countries. Now, they did use the United States, but they only used one community, and that was Davis, California. That was supposed to represent all the American children. And then they also looked at data from Brazil, Norway, India, Oman, and Ghana. And the World Health Organization picked children a bit differently than the CDC did when they did their growth charts. They only included infants in high socioeconomic groups in an attempt to limit bias caused by poor nutrition. They also picked more kids whose mothers were well-educated and worked outside the home. And all the mothers were non-smokers, and all babies were singletons. That means no twins or triplets. And all of them were full-term. The infants also had to breastfeed exclusively for at least 4 months, but most of them breastfed a full 12 months. And they also controlled when solid food was introduced to all of these babies, which was at about 5 months of age. Is anybody seeing a problem here? You know, the World Health Organization basically created a large sample of perfect babies to compare with the world. You know what I'm saying? All right, so what are the differences in these charts, the CDC ones that we use now and these new World Health Organization charts? Well, this group of perfectly selected children are smaller than the American kids from the 70s and 80s. So if we use these charts in America now, fewer kids would be below the 5th percentile and more of our kids would be above the 95th percentile. So why change? You know, why change from what we use now to the World Health Organization ones? I mean, this is really the big question. Why should we compare our kids to those in Oman and Ghana? I mean, why not repeat the statistical analysis on a large sample of our own population and just have our own growth charts for America? Well, the problem with that is that the chart would move in the other direction. With the current rates of childhood obesity in America, more kids are overweight compared to the 70s and 80s, which would elevate the 50th percentile and put fewer kids over the 95th percentile. I know this all sounds confusing. Let me put it this way. If we redo the charts based on today's population in the U.S., then what we now call overweight would suddenly be called normal since so many kids are obese, right? Well, of course, we can't have that. On the other hand, if we go with the World Health Organization charts, even more kids appear overweight because now we're comparing them to smaller kids. That may not be a bad thing for the Department of Health and Human Services because then they can lobby for more money to combat the problem, which they conveniently made to look worse than it really is. But in reality, you know, it's only worse because they're comparing our kids to children in Oman and Ghana. So what's the bottom line? Well, I think it's crazy to change our growth charts either way. Look, absolute percentile isn't even what's important. What's important is comparing a child's height to their weight, looking at a child's overall growth trend and comparing that trend to their family's pattern while putting it into context with the child's overall health. We need to spend less time and energy drawing little pretty circles on graph paper and spend more time figuring out how to help American children eat less and exercise more. Okay, enough on that. Vision checks. This is an important topic, and it stems from some listener mail that I got. What I'd like to do is just talk a little bit about vision screenings for each age group. And we're going to start, I know this is the toddler segment, but I think I've mentioned before that some of these topics are going to sort of span from one age group to another. So in babies, let's talk about vision screens there. Currently, many states require newborn hearing screens in an effort to pick up hearing impairments early on, but vision checks in babies are not done routinely. Why is that? Well, vision is a subjective thing, and babies aren't telling you what they can and can't see. Now, there are devices that utilize laser technology to see if kids in infancy are farsighted or nearsighted, but you aren't going to put glasses on a newborn infant, you know, so why bother? What infants do need is a good eye exam by a pediatrician. The eye exam for infants is relatively simple and straightforward. You want to make sure their pupils are equal and react to light. You want to make sure the eyes are symmetrical, they move in all directions, and they move together for the most part. And I say for the most part because young infants may appear to have intermittent brief episodes where one eye goes in a little bit or out a little bit, and this usually improves within a few weeks. If it's severe or it persists past a few weeks of age, you want to be sure to let your doctor know about that. The other important part of a newborn eye exam is checking for a red reflex. Now, this is like the red eye you see in photographs. And what causes red eye? Well, light from the camera flash enters the pupil, it travels through the eye, hits the back of the retina, the back of the eye, which is known as the retina. The retina contains lots of tiny red blood vessels, So the red light waves bounce off of the retina and come back out the pupil. So the lens of the camera picks up the red reflection, and all the other light wave colors are absorbed by the retina. Only the red ones are the ones that bounce off. That's why we see the color red, if you remember from your physics classes. All right, enough of that. When doctors examine a baby's eyes, we don't use a camera flash, of course, but what we do use is a light source and a lens, just like a camera. We shine a light in each eye, and we look for the red reflex. Now, why do we do this? Well, if you see a nice, bright red reflex, then you know the space between the pupil and the retina is clear. If there is a cataract or a tumor in the eye, then a normal red reflex does not appear. So that's why it's important to have that checked out. And anything inside the eye, such as cataract or a tumor, has to be addressed in the infant period, because if the brain isn't getting a good picture, and we talked about this, I believe it was in episode 2, when we talked about lazy eye, but if the brain's not getting a good picture, over time, it starts to just shut that eye down. And once you lose vision in an eye because the brain is ignoring the eye, it's lost permanently. So that's why it's really important to pick up cataracts and tumors inside the eye during the infant period. Now, for toddlers, the best eye exam really is close observation by the child's parents. You'll want to bring any problems or concerns to your doctor's attention. Now, what kind of things should arouse concern? Well, if your child's routinely getting really close to books, games, toys, television, routinely unable to see faraway objects that seem to be seen by the rest of the family, and then also routine clumsiness that just seems extreme to you, why should you only be concerned if these problems are extreme? Well, you know, toddlers often do strange things we don't always understand, and those of you with toddlers at home know exactly what I'm talking about. So, I mean, they may sometimes get real close to books and games and toys and TV if they're really interested, and they may be stubborn enough to deny seeing faraway objects, and clumsiness at this age is common because their brains are often several steps ahead of their feet. But still, if these things occur routinely or seem extreme, then you want to let your doctor know. The other thing to watch for in toddlers is one eye gazing slightly inward or outward compared to the other eye. And this may be strabismus, which can lead to amblyopia or lazy eye. And again, this can progress to permanent blindness in the lazy eye if you fail to intervene. And again, for a detailed description of strabismus and lazy eye, I do believe it was episode 2 of the program where we discuss that in a lot of detail. Okay, what about before kindergarten? Well, kids with no previously defined vision problems or suspicion of problem really should get their first official vision test just prior to kindergarten. Now, who should do this test? Well, for one, the school will do it during the pre-kindergarten screening, and then your pediatrician will also do one at the pre-kindergarten well-child check. If your child passes both of those exams and you've not had any previous concerns with vision, then I think you can comfortably assume that vision is fine. Now, granted, these screenings are simple eye chart exams, and they'll identify problems with acuity, such as nearsightedness and farsightedness. They don't specifically pick up astigmatism or color blindness or glaucoma, but keep this in mind. The vast, vast, vast majority of vision problems in young kids is going to be nearsightedness, and then sometimes some farsightedness too. Astigmatism almost always accompanies nearsightedness or farsightedness. It's not usually there by itself with 20/20 vision. So if we pick up an acuity problem in the screening, we're going to refer those kids to a pediatric ophthalmologist, and the astigmatism will get picked up on that secondary exam. Now, what about color blindness? Well, color blindness tends to run in families. There's a simple test for it that consists of looking at pictures, and some schools and doctors include that in their screening. If your doctor or school doesn't test for color blindness and you have no family history of color blindness and your child's doing well learning and differentiating colors, especially red and green, then really likely there's no problem. But, you know, if you're really worried about it, you can do a Google search for color blindness and pull up the little pictures and test your child yourself at home. You remember them. It's a circle with a little tiny circles inside of different colors. They've got some numbers, like numbers in green circles with surrounded by red circles. And you just see if the child can pick out the numbers and see them. Now, with regard to glaucoma, congenital glaucoma is usually picked up in infancy because of an abnormal exam and possible cataract formation that's often associated with it. Open-angle glaucoma is very rare in kids, and when it does happen, there's usually a strong family history of it, so oftentimes you pick it up that way. So, and that's the next point, too. If you have a strong family history of any eye problem, then your child probably should see a pediatric ophthalmologist, you know, around the pre-kindergarten age. And earlier, if the family history is an early childhood eye disease, such as amblyopia or lazy eye. Now, how about an optometrist? Well, I wouldn't at this age. Now, what's the difference between an optometrist and an ophthalmologist? Well, optometrists have an OD behind their name. They're trained to prescribe glasses and contacts. They screen for serious eye disease, and they manage relatively simple eye conditions. If they find a serious problem, they're going to refer to an ophthalmologist. To become an optometrist, most people leave college after 2 or 3 years and then enter a 4-year school of optometry. Pediatric ophthalmologists, on the other hand, are medical doctors, so they're going to have an MD or a DO behind their name. They finish 4 years of college, followed by 4 years of medical school, followed by a year of internship, then 3 years of residency, and 1 or 2 years of a fellowship in pediatric ophthalmology. Okay, maybe I'm also a little biased, you know, since I'm a medical doctor, but this is the only eye professional where I would refer a young child. You can usually find one associated with a nearby children's hospital. Now, he or she may not have an office in your neighborhood, but I think you'll find it's well worth the drive. Now, there has been some controversy lately in this arena. The American Academy of Pediatrics and the American Academy of Ophthalmologists basically recommend what I've outlined here. The American Optometric Association, on the other hand, recommends eye exams by an eye doctor at 6 months of age, 3 years of age, and 5 years of age. Apparently, they don't trust the eye exams performed by primary care doctors. That's okay. I don't trust their recommendation, so I guess we're even. Now, what about older children and teenagers? Well, for school-age kids and teens, yearly eye exams and vision screenings are a reasonable component of the yearly well-child examination. And then if you notice a concern, or if there's a significant family history that comes to your attention, or if a screening is failed, then referral to a pediatric ophthalmologist is warranted. Also, I would pay particular attention to screening both vision and hearing for kids with learning problems and ADHD. You certainly want to make sure a vision or hearing problem is not contributing to the academic issues. Now, a final word on this whole referral business is in order. If you want your child to see a pediatric ophthalmologist, maybe because of a concern you have or because of a family history or because of a failed screening or simply because you want them to see an ophthalmologist because it's going to give you peace of mind. And then if your primary care doctor won't give you a referral or at least point you in the right direction, what you can do is just call your nearest children's hospital and find out who the pediatric ophthalmologists there are and then make an appointment. And this even goes for teenagers. A referral, you have to remember, is not an admission ticket. A referral is simply a mechanism that some insurance companies use in determining whether to approve or deny a claim. Many insurers no longer require referrals. But let's say your insurance company requires a referral and you don't have one, so you have to pay out of pocket for one visit. Because if the eye doctor finds a problem, I guarantee you'll get that referral for your next visit. So what, you're looking at $100 or so. How much do you pay in a year for oil changes or cigarettes or cable TV or internet access? I mean, if you're that concerned about your child's vision, pay to have it examined. Don't give up on your conviction just because your insurance company won't pay for one measly visit. Okay, this week our school age segment consists of an interview with KT. She's a 12-year-old homeschooled 7th grader, and let's get right to the interview. We have a special guest this week on Pediacast. I'd like to introduce everyone to Katie. Katie is a 12-year-old 7th grader who homeschools rather than going to public school. So welcome to the program, Katie.
Hi.
How are you today?
I'm good.
Appreciate you coming on Pediacast to talk to our listeners. So you go to school at home. You don't get on a bus or walk to a different building. You actually do your classes in your house. Is that right?
Yeah, the farthest I ever have to travel is down the stairs and through the hall.
So do you like learning at home, or do you wish that you were going to school?
Well, it varies. Most of the time, I'm glad though that I'm homeschooled.
Who teaches you? Is it your mom and dad at home?
Yeah, both of them. They share subjects.
I see. And you have a brother at home, I understand.
Yeah, I think he's in 4th grade. He's 9.
You think he's in fourth grade?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. I don't really keep up with him very much.
It is a little bit harder to remember what grade you're in, isn't it?
Yeah. I always almost say, oh, I'm in seventh grade.
Yeah, it's a little harder to keep track. So what's your favorite subject in homeschooling?
I like science and composition.
And why do you like those the best?
Because in science, you can do experiments and learn about how stuff works and all that. And composition, it's fun to make up stories and write on the computer.
So you do science lab at home, too?
Yeah, every once in a while there's an experiment, but sometimes there's some that we don't do because they don't seem like they're going to work or they really don't need to do it to explain anything anymore.
So you feel like you understand it and sometimes it's just a little busy work.
Yeah. If it's something cool like putting Drano in Jell-O, then yeah, without eating it, of course.
Putting Drano in Jell-O? I have to make a comment. Please don't try that at home, at least without homeschooling supervision. No, but seriously, it doesn't sound like such a good thing to put Drano in Jell-O. Where do you come up with the material that you use? Like, who's telling you to put Drano in Jell-O?
We use this program called K-12, and they provide all of the experiments and online lessons and materials that you need for it. Well, most of the materials.
Oh, I see. So, you actually do your schoolwork on the computer for the most part?
No, it's about half and half. There are online lessons that explain stuff, but then you do like reading and stuff offline most of the time. But then when you're done reading, like for literature, when you're done reading, you go back and do a check your reading, and it asks questions about what you just read, and you answer them like a little fill-in-the-bubble on the computer.
Oh, that sounds neat. So you kind of blend the traditional stuff with technology as well.
Yeah.
Now, let's say you're doing these laboratory experiments. Where do your parents get the equipment that they would need to do lab experiments? Like, is there a lab store nearby or something, and you take a supply list and go pick things up? Or how do you get all the materials?
No, for a lot of the materials, they send it to us when they send us all of our books. They'll send us, like, graduated cylinders and thermometers and stuff like that, but a lot of it is there'll be this thing that pops up. It'll say advanced preparation, and then it'll say like you need to have this for a few lessons later.
So you said that the material that you use comes from a place called K-12. Is that right?
Yeah.
And I did a little bit of research before we started the interview, and apparently folks can find out more information about K-12 if they go to www.k12.com, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes too, so people will be able to find it pretty easily. Okay, so what about your brother? Does he use that same curriculum too?
Yeah, he just does a different grade of it, easier problems.
I see. So he does all the stuff that you did a couple years ago.
Yep, basically.
Does he get hand-me-down materials?
For some of the things, yeah. A lot of the things, though, we'll reorder from K-12 for him. But, like, some of the things, like my math book, which this year and last year was really nicer than it was last year or 2 years ago. So he'll use some of that stuff, but most of it we get new because you do write in a lot of the books.
What's your least favorite subject?
Definitely math.
Math?
Yeah.
Yeah, I wasn't a real big math fan either, to be honest with you. But you hang in there and you get it done, right?
Yeah, I usually pass all the assessments, so.
But it's just, it doesn't come as easy to you, huh?
Yeah.
Now, who's your math teacher?
My mom does that.
And does she answer all your questions pretty well? Does she explain things so that you can understand it?
Yeah, sometimes I'll have to wait because she's working with my brother, but yeah.
I see. So since you're doing this school stuff at home, what parts of public school do you feel like you're missing? Like what do you think the advantage that the kids have who are going to public school, what kind of advantage do they have over the experience that you're getting?
They spend all day with their friends, and I can't do that because I'm at home most of the time. But I do spend time with my friends, so.
So you just have to find different times to be with them that's not necessarily during school hours.
Yeah.
I guess that, yeah, go ahead, I'm sorry.
I'm on different schedule type thing with vacations at different times and stuff.
Now, one of the biggest complaints that you hear out there about homeschooling is the lack of socialization. Do you know what I mean by that?
Yeah.
Like being with other kids the same age, and maybe because you don't spend as much time with other kids that you might have problems, you know, forming friendships and getting along with others. Is that a problem for you?
Not really. We do all sorts of activities. We act in plays and do theater, and sometimes we'll take swimming lessons. And there's a lot of kids around us who are the same age. So, yeah.
So you have experience being around other kids and making friends, and that sort of thing comes pretty easy for you.
Yeah.
I see.
And I go to camp every year, and so I make a lot of friends there.
Right. And do you go to Sunday school?
Yeah.
So you have friends there, too, that you see?
Yeah.
Now, your friends, are most of them also homeschooled, or do you have a lot of friends who also go to public school?
I've got one friend, I think, who's homeschooled, but most of them go to public school, which makes it a little bit tricky to get together with them unless it's in the summer.
Right. Now, do you think that you'll continue to homeschool throughout all of your schooling, or is this just something that you're going to do until high school, and then your parents are going to have you go to public school at that point?
No, I'll probably go through high school, but I'm going to go to college normal, obviously, because I don't even think they have a homeschool for college.
You can't do college at home, no.
No.
Well, do you feel like your homeschool experience is going to prepare you for college?
Yeah, a little bit with the studying on your own. So,
you when you're studying at home, do you take notes and that kind of thing too?
For some of the subjects I do, for science I do, when there's something really important, and same with history, but for math and stuff like that, I usually don't.
So you're learning how to take notes and try to filter out what's important and what's not important, and learning to study for tests. Do you take tests?
Yeah, at the end of every lesson we have assessments, and then at the end of each semester we have a big assessment for everything we've learned.
I see. So you are getting some practice at taking tests and taking notes and that sort of thing. So it sounds like you'll be fairly prepared for college.
Yeah, probably.
Now, what about music class? Does your mom help you learn how to play an instrument or do choir or something like that?
No, we do piano lessons. I don't know where it is, but we do piano lessons every week. So I know how to play the piano.
Oh, that's excellent. What about art class and gym class? Do you do either of those kind of things?
Sometimes we go to this thing called Swim Gym and Art at the YMCA. It's got swim lessons, and then there's art classes, and you do projects and paint and stuff, and then there's a gym class, too.
Well, that sounds interesting. What kind of things do they do in the gym class?
Mostly play games, like dodgeball and stuff, but sometimes we'll do hockey or basketball or something.
Yeah, I was never very good at dodgeball.
No.
Do you ever play crab soccer?
No.
That was one where you had to walk on your hands and legs, but with your your back facing down and your belly button facing up in the air, and you're kind of like walking around like a crab with your arms and legs. And you
that
had,
doesn't sound very good.
And it was like soccer. You had to kick this ball back and forth. No, it wasn't very good at all, to be honest with you. I'm glad they don't do it anymore.
Yeah. I like dodgeball, where they have things that you can hide behind.
Yeah. that would have been the bigger kids for me. How about drama class? Are you involved in any drama kind of stuff?
Yeah. I just auditioned for a play not too long ago. I didn't get in. My brother got a call back, but he didn't get in either. But there's a show that's coming up, and just auditions are Sunday or something like that. And I'm going to audition for that.
Okay. What now, is that through your local school?
No, that's actually through this place in Columbus called the Children's Theater.
Uh-huh.
And I've also been in a show at the Davis, and my brother's done things at the Phoenix in Columbus. So
you guys are really into acting, huh?
Yeah, I am. My brother doesn't appreciate how easy he gets parts.
Why does he get parts so easily?
Well, there's typically more girls auditioning than boys, so it's much harder to get a part than it is for a boy to get a part. And usually they have fewer girl parts anyway.
Oh, I see. So he doesn't appreciate the parts that he gets, and you really want the parts, but it's harder because there's a lot more girls who are trying out.
Yeah, he appreciates them, but not as much as I would.
I see.
He doesn't even want to do acting when he gets older.
And you do?
Yeah, I want to be in movies.
Oh, that's great. Well, you know, it sounds like you're pretty busy. So you have all your homeschool stuff that you do, and then you have piano lessons, and you do this drama stuff, and swim, gym, and art, and then you're
around. I used to do ballet.
And you used to do ballet, too?
I'm not going to do it this year, though.
Just a little bit too much on your plate?
Yeah, I've been doing it 5 years, though.
Oh, wow. 5 years of ballet and you're going to stop? Why?
Yeah, I want to do more for acting. Last year, there was a play I wanted to audition for, Little Women, and I couldn't do it because I would have missed like half of my ballet rehearsals for the recital at the end of the year, so I decided not to do it and open up more possibilities for acting.
Oh, that sounds great. Well, it sounds like you got your priorities set and you're happy with the way school's going. And
yeah.
I think you'll do well. So I really appreciate you coming on the program today and letting our listeners get an idea of someone who homeschools and what it's like at home.
Mm-hmm.
So thanks for coming. And will you come back and join us? All right. Now, I have to come clean here. Katie really is a 12-year-old homeschool student. But she's also my daughter. Now, I know I conducted this interview as if she were a stranger, but you have to realize my intentions were good. The point wasn't to fool my listeners out there, but to test out my equipment and see if I had the parts I needed to do a Skype interview. It was also a good learning experience for my daughter, and I thought it might give me some insight, you know, on how she viewed her education. I have to say I'm quite pleased and proud of her responses. But, you know, instead of burning the interview onto a CD and locking it away in a memory box, I thought I'd share it with you. And the final segment of our show this week is our teenage segment. We're going to talk about eating disorders this week. Anorexia nervosa and bulimia are eating disorders that begin with a distorted image of one's body. They're most common in teenage girls, although younger girls, adult women, and sometimes boys and men are also affected. Nobody knows for sure how this distorted body image begins, but it probably results from a combination of brain chemistry alterations, environmental experiences, and genetic predispositions. In the typical scenario, a teenage girl or young adult woman feels and believes she's fat, when she clearly is not. Oftentimes, other mood and mental disorders such as depression, anxiety, bipolar, and obsessive-compulsive disease coexist with the eating disorder, which is why we believe brain chemistry likely plays an important part. Now, signs and symptoms of eating disorders are really also the warning signs for parents. Here's what to watch for. Severe weight loss from strict dieting. With bulimia, you also see binge eating, which is defined as eating large amounts of food in a short time, followed by purging or making yourself throw up, taking laxatives or water pills. The frequent vomiting allows acid to dissolve tooth enamel, which can result in a lot of dental problems. It also results in electrolyte imbalances, which can result in fatal heart rhythms. In both types of eating disorders, we also see weakness and dizziness from malnourishment and dehydration. Hormone imbalances may cause an increase in body hair, brittle nails, and feelings of being constantly cold and unable to stay warm. These hormone changes accompanied by low amounts of body fat often result in termination of menstrual periods, too. Now, if depression or bipolar disease accompany the eating disorder, which is often the case, You may see withdrawal from friends and usual activities and decreased interest in things that they used to enjoy. Appetites seem diminished, yet they constantly think about food. They often count calories and carbs and grams of fat in an obsessive way, but strongly deny any of these behaviors if you confront them. They tend to exercise an unusual amount of time and fear weight gain and even try to lose more weight when everyone around them can plainly see they're normal or underweight. Now, identifying these kids and getting them help is tough. You know, they seldom ask for help, so as a parent, you have to intervene. Unfortunately, many mothers suffered or suffer from the same problem or simply don't wish to admit or confront the issue, so many of these kids continue to suffer because of parental neglect. If you're concerned, you know, call your child's doctor. Treatment first addresses physical safety. You know, we have to correct dehydration and electrolyte imbalances to prevent fatal heart rhythms. You also have to determine if there is a suicide risk, especially if depression or bipolar is coexisting with the eating disorder. And then once we address physical issues, we turn to the psychological component. Lifelong counseling and group support are important in restoring and maintaining a normal body image. And you have to address and treat any coexisting mental health problems along with the eating disorder. Now, once these issues are out in the open, many teenagers and young adults are relieved. You know, it's like a weight being lifted that their loved ones finally understand and want to help them without being critical about it. And these teens who end up wanting help really are the easiest ones to treat. Now, let me say a quick word about the ones who are a little bit more difficult, and these tend to be the younger teenagers who are still in a me-against-the-world mentality, if you know what I mean. You know, you still have to treat the physical and the psychological, as I've outlined, but many of these younger patients relapse and fail in their treatment, and for them, sometimes a tough love approach is required to keep them out of harm's way. Now, how do you do that? Well, weekly weight checks with a goal weight and a minimum tolerated weight is a good first start. If they go below the minimum weight, then they're admitted to an inpatient facility, and this can be a hospital or a psychiatric clinic. But the key here is that if they go below that minimum weight, they're going to get admitted, and there's no exceptions and no negotiations. Okay, they'll not be released until they're back up above their minimum weight, plus a percentage above that. When they go in, at first they have absolutely no privileges, basically except to sit in the doorway of their room and eat meals. And then as they gain weight, they gain privileges back. So put on a pound and they can shower and brush their teeth again. Gain another pound and they can sit inside their room. Gain another and they can read a book. Gain another and they can watch TV. Now, it may sound mean, but you have to remember these are young teens who aren't that far removed from sticker chart days and positive reinforcement and suspension of privileges at home and groundings and that sort of thing. Sometimes it's the only way to keep them at a healthy weight. And as hard as it is for parents to see this happen, you know, to that precious baby who they used to rock to sleep, they have to remember it may be their only hope of saving that baby's life once an eating disorder has reached this level of seriousness. Now, what's the long-term outlook for a person with an eating disorder? Well, you know, it's a life journey. It's like any other chronic illness. It's important to stay connected to a counselor that you trust and support groups that help. And you have to stick with reasonable diets and exercise plans. And you have to be accountable to someone who loves you and is willing to step in and intervene if the progress is slipping. It takes courage and guts and lots of support. If anyone listening to this podcast has an eating disorder or knows someone who has an eating disorder, please don't continue sitting back doing nothing about it. Seek help. Confront your friends or loved one. And if you don't know where to turn and you can't talk to a friend, ask your doctor or teacher or pastor what you should do. Always remember, you're not alone. And you can find help online from the National Eating Disorders Association, and they're located at www.edap.org. That's www.edap.org. And of course, we'll include a link to their site in the show notes. Well, folks, that wraps up this week's edition of PediaCast. Thanks for tuning in. Don't forget, if there's a topic you'd like to hear on the program, drop us a line on the contact page, which you'll find at www.pediascribe.com/podcast. And you can also email us at podcast@pediascribe.com. Or you can leave us a voicemail at 347-404-KIDS. That's 347-404-KIDS. As always, we appreciate your support. If you like PediaCast, be sure to tell your friends and family about the program. And if you have time to leave us some feedback, in the iTunes Music Store or at Podcast Pickle. That would be appreciated because other parents do read those comments and use them to base their selections. Now, if you don't like what you're hearing on PDAcast, either write us an email telling us how you think we can improve, or simply unsubscribe and pretend we never existed. Yeah, that's the ticket. Nah, just kidding. We want to know what you think, really. We're going to leave you this week with a song from our featured artist, Tim Jennings. Tim is a pop, R&B, and jazz keyboardist and vocalist from the Buckeye State, Ohio. He composes, performs, records, and produces his own music, which you can find at music.podshow.com. This is one he calls More Each Day. So until next week, this is Dr. Mike Patrick Jr. saying stay smart, stay healthy, and stay involved with your kids. So long, everybody.
Love you more.